Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Got my co-host, Dr. Carl. Today we got the very famous Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford, who is at Harvard. She's a MedPeds trained MD, PhD. Did you say MBA?
MD, MPH, MPA, MBA. That's okay,
you got it. Everything.
And one of the first, or the first?
Three-year
fellowship trained obesity medicine.
Yes.
And sports medicine trained ortho. You got a lot there going on. But people may know her from there was a couple of years ago on 60 Minutes. She was on 60 Minutes talking about obesity and genetics and the medicines, caused some uproar around people that don't understand kind of some of the genetics. We actually did a podcast all about.
Yeah, that's right.
We did a response even to a few people that were making posts about it, and we had to go on and explain and stuff like that. So we're really glad to have you on the podcast. You're one of the one of these OG, obviously, trained obesity trained doctor. So welcome. Thanks for coming on. And you lift. You're a doctor who lifts.
It was a lifting day too. I alternate my strength and cardio days.
There we go.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So the reason this happened is because she and I were on a MedPage Today talk. And that's really geared towards other physicians talking about these, new medications, newish medications. And towards the, I can't remember how this went, but towards the end, we're talking about strength training. And she told me straight up that she could leg press more than I could. And I said, well, then you got to come onto the podcast.
And I'm pretty confident still. And yeah, you guys can see I have a straight face.
I know you do. Yes, you do. I want to hear a little bit about your athletic background because our athletic background and science led us to this sort of field for me into endocrinology and obesity medicine, Spencer into family medicine and obesity medicine. So tell us about your athletic background.
Absolutely. So I have been an athlete my entire life. I'll start with kind of where I started, which was dance. I'm trained in ballet, jazz, West African hip hop, and point. I minored in dance in college, choreographed for Emory's Dance Company, used to teach for the Georgia Ballet. But I'm also a track athlete. So I was second in the state of Georgia in the 200 meters.
Wow.
So I'm a sprinter. I think as I've gotten older, so we were talking about this before we came on today, I'm in my mid-40s now, can still run relatively fast. But I think as I've gotten older, I've recruited some slow twitch muscle fibers so I can definitely run much longer than I used to run when I was younger. So, when we were training as sprinters back in the day, they would make us run cross country. And we were like, this is a joke. Nobody comes to see the cross country runners. Everybody comes to see the sprinters. I mean, can you name any cross country runners? Nobody can. Everybody can name the sprinters. And back in the day, we were all into the FloJo era. And, we were really excited about the sprinters, your Carl Lewis's, your Michael Johnson's, et cetera. Yeah. I mean, you can name those. And people that are, in our age range still remember those people's names. And you know who they are. Unfortunately, people like FloJo aren't living. But we still know who they are. And these were the people that were definitely inspirational for me. And when we talk about that, kind of running those cross country races for the sprinters, we would just kind of like walk the initial part and then we like sprint the end of the race and we'd be like, yay, let's run through the finish line. But it's interesting, as I've gotten older, I can actually run much longer distances. And so I think maybe my body's become conditioned differently. I don't know, but I think it literally there's been some conversion over to this kind of slow twitch muscle fiber. And I'm like, wow, how come I can run like that back when I was like in my teens and 20s? Maybe in 20s, I guess I started to get a little bit better conditioning as a runner. And as someone who owns a Peloton tread, row and bike, I'm definitely always going to be best on the tread, followed by the row. Actually, my weakest is the bike, which is surprising. But if you're looking at where you know, between the three of those, I'm always going to be by far the best one on the trail, which makes, I guess, sense if I was a runner my whole life.
Are you so a shill for Peloton?
No, I don't. You know what?
They need to Peloton, pay you for this.
Peloton, if you're listening, would not mind being on the corporate board. I'm just saying. Yeah,
there
just
we
saying.
Go.
That's actually, that saying. Maybe they'd sponsor should, the podcast.
You know, just saying. Just saying.
Sponsor the podcast. Exercise Dr. Stanford yeah. on your board.
Mentioning this, just if you're listening,
just throwing it out there. Someone might be connected. They're going to reach out to you. What got you in? So you're an athlete. Mm-hmm. Sprinters are pretty jacked too. So what got you into obesity medicine?
Well, you know, I think it was a really circuitous path to obesity. But if we go back to the late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of my initial interest in research was really around that preventive side. A lot of the work that mm-hmm. we really understand about the pathophysiology of obesity, I would say we didn't really know back then. So a lot of my early research was with a gentleman by the name of Dr. Ken Resnikow at Emory. And so a lot of our work at Emory at the time, Atlanta, which is my hometown, it's obviously not where I live. I'm in Boston now. It's much colder and obviously a lot further north where I grew up, was looking at a lot of prevention, particularly in the Black community in Atlanta. Why do I specifically call out the Black community? His work was looking in the Black church community, particularly a project called Healthy Body, Healthy Spirit, looking at prevention and work in the Black church community. Then with that program, another program and research that he was doing was called Go Girls. If you guys can harken back to In Living Color. A throwback to that type of work. And we were looking at how to do work with regards to overweight and obesity within Black adolescent girls. And another program that was centered around the WIC community, specifically targeting not necessarily per se the Black community, but unfortunately, a lot of the people worse just still happen to be in that group if you were looking at those with a lower socioeconomic position. So a lot of the work was around prevention. How do we change food and how do we look at physical activity within those communities? And so a lot of that work specifically at that time, late 90s, early 2000s, 2001, was really around that scope. If we fast forward through a lot of different ups and downs, I really came into recognizing that a lot of what I was doing in medicine was we were kind of coming about it the wrong way. We were always kind of treating all of the downstream impacts of obesity. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, let's treat this and let's treat this and let's treat this and let's treat this. And I was like, wait a minute. Well, we're never treating the key thing that's causing all of the things. We're treating the hypertension. Yeah. We're treating the obstructive sleep apnea. We're treating the type 2 diabetes. But why are we not treating the obesity? And I think it was because we really at that time didn't really know how to treat the obesity itself. We knew how to possibly prevent, or I said we knew how to possibly, I'm using air quotes for those who aren't watching me. And so I became very frustrated with not knowing what to do and seeing that a lot of the things that I was working on were, you know, appearing to be ineffective, for lack mm-hmm. of a better way of saying it. And so there was a bit of a circuitous path because there wasn't like, hey, let me go sign up to do, you know, become an obesity medicine physician. That really wasn't a direct path to that work. And so I would say, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the answer to this question, it was a bit of a circuitous path, but really a very early interest in that in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, I love it. It's kind of similar.
I was going to say relatively similar to us from the athletic background. Yeah.
So then you got into it, and somehow how'd you go up to Boston? What was your path?
So that's a really interesting story. You know, a lot of people haven't really heard this story. So so I did MedPeed. So that's for those of you who are unaware, it's a 4-year residency where you kind of juggle back and forth between doing internal medicine. And the way my program was set up, you did 3 months of internal medicine, 3 months of peds, 3 months of internal medicine, 3 months of pediatrics, going back and forth. And you know, it was really kind of somewhere between, I think maybe first and second year of residency, I was like, what am I going to do with my life? I have no idea what I'm going to do. I definitely don't want to be just do general medicine and general peds. And I was sitting and I just intubated 3 kids in the pediatric ICU one night, which means I was not going to sleep. So I just said, let me come and hang out with the nurses and the RTs, basically. So I Googled obesity in medicine. And the fellowship here at Harvard popped up, and I was like, hey, it's 2:30 in the morning. My posture, you know, kind of got very straight. And I was like, I called my husband. My husband was 2:30 in the morning. I was like, hey, babe, there's this obesity medicine fellowship in Boston at Harvard. He's like, really? I was like, yeah. He said, what does that mean? I was like, I don't know, but it sounds like something I should do. I think you should do some more research. But I was like, okay, fair point. I think I should also maybe go back to sleep. I said, okay, that's also a fair point. This was, you know, obviously relatively early in my residency. So I did some additional research. I called them up, did some, you know, emailing, and they were like, well, we don't have outside rotators. I was in South Carolina at the time. I was doing my residency there. And they were like, well, we don't do rotations. And I was like, well, I think we have enough time to have you develop an outside rotation. And by the time I was a fourth year, I rotated at MGH, first month of my fourth year of residency. And I was like, these people are using medications. Yeah. What is this thought process? And at the time, we really didn't have the GLP-1s. This was right. Very early. But they were using a lot of the generics, Phentermine, Topiramate, Proprion, Zonisamide, all these meds. They were combining things. They were just doing it patient after patient. And I was like, look at this. So I returned back to my home program in South Carolina. I was in Columbia. And, you know, I went back. But, you know, as a resident, you don't have control over what you do. I mean, you can write scripts to your doctor, but you still have to have sign off from your attending physicians. Yeah. So these medications were inexpensive, right? These were generic meds. Mm-hmm. And my patient population was of lower socioeconomic position as a resident. That's typically the type of clinic you are often with. And so I was like, oh, but I can use the meds. They're not cost prohibitive. There's no prior authorizations. And but I was met with significant resistance from my attending physician.
Yeah.
So they were like, well, no, Dr. You know, not Dr. Stanford. I was Fatima. No, Fatima. Well, you know, we're not going to do that. And I was like, but no, but I'd spent a month, right? So I kind of felt like I had, you know, some chops on me. I was like, we could do this. Can we at least try this? No. I don't, because they were not familiar, right? Yep. So I can't take back this to them because they had not been taught. And so I felt like my hands were tied, and I felt very frustrated. You know, hindered, for lack of a better way of saying it, that I couldn't utilize any of what I had learned, even with no, you know, cost prohibitions on this patient population where I thought some of these strategies could have been effective. And so at this point, I was left with wanting to do one of two things. I applied for the fellowship here where they took one fellow a year. And I had also applied for the White House fellowship in the Obama administration. I made it to regional finals in the Obama administration for the White House fellowship, and I was obviously picked to be a fellow here. And you guys know where I ended up, so I ended up here.
Wow! Butterfly effect. What would you be doing if you got the White House thing? We don't even know.
Who knows?
We don't even know.
Obviously, you know, it depends on where I would have gotten placed during that administration. You know, you get assigned to different places during that administration. But I think, you know, you ultimately end up where you're supposed to end up. And I ended up here, and the rest is history.
That is great.
That's awesome.
I love it. I'm glad that breaking news and nobody's heard that story. So we are first to break that. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, so one of the waves that, you know, that's a pretty good segue. You talk about, you know, your history of exercise, you knew a lot about the physiology, the pathophysiology. You knew that nutrition and exercise were keys to preventing, delaying obesity, and then the downstream thing. So we talk about this all the time. And you and I, certainly being similar age, probably were, you know, I was thinking about this back then too, like, well, wait a second, type 2 diabetes is essentially a complication of obesity. And then we're still dealing with all the downstream complications of type 2 diabetes. We got to treat the root issue. And of course, then we talk, you know, we get into primordial and then primary prevention and nutrition and exercise, just prevent, you know, hoping to try to prevent the whole thing. And that's really sounds like what you did a lot of in undergrad, if I'm not mistaken, which is awesome.
Undergrad and in my first master's. Yeah.
And we've, you know, we've talked a lot about, and in the podcast 2 years ago, when we actually responded to your 60 Minutes episode about, we talk about this all the time, the complex inheritability, the genetics of obesity. And one of your quotes in that interview was, you know, if your parents, you know, have obesity, you have a 50-85% of having the disease. And, you know, something about, you know, despite optimal diet, exercise, sleep management, stress management, what didn't come across apparently to a lot of people is that that comes across as very black and white. And obviously you alluded to that there certainly are a lot of studies that show nutrition, exercise, all those things can help delay, prevent obesity. The problem is we have this obesogenic environment that's, you know, the whole loading the gun, pulling the trigger we often talk a lot about. But maybe you can give us a little bit more detail because you maybe even, you know, published some of the stuff back then. I mean, I know, you know, just for example, back in 2011, there was the big FTO variants and meta-analysis, physical activity can attenuate. People don't probably know that term necessarily, but attenuate the influence of that very famous obesity gene variant on those from, you know, really getting to the point of obesity, but it's certainly not perfect. And, you know, maybe you can just kind of talk about some of that stuff and the nuance and the, you know,
without having to get that complex. I mean, I was the person that convinced the AMA to acknowledge obesity as a chronic disease back in 2013. And I want to take you guys to that story, and maybe I'll explain to you or to this particular audience exactly how I explained it to the AMA before their pivotal vote to acknowledge obesity as a chronic disease in 2013. Actually, I didn't know when I was going to the AMA to speak on obesity as a chronic disease that their vote was about to happen. I was not privy to that somehow, even though I had been a prominent member of the AMA. I got a call, hey, Fatima, will you come and speak about obesity as a chronic disease to the AMA? I was like, yeah, of course. I've been really active in the AMA at this point for about 10 years. They were like, okay, well, come and speak. I'm going to get to this point because it's really important. I'm going to explain this key point that you're talking about in terms of genetics and how I explained it that will help people understand. So I come to the AMA. They say, okay, Fatima, you know, can you do a roundtable discussion? I said, oh, absolutely. We can do a roundtable discussion. Let's talk about this as a disease. I get there. They say, okay, well, no, we'd like for you to do a TED talk. I was like, well, that's very different from a roundtable discussion. Okay. I guess I can turn that into a time. When would you like for me to do that? Can you do that in about 15 minutes? Okay, well, I guess I'll do a TED talk in 15 minutes. How long would you like for that to last? It will last for 15 minutes. Okay. So you like a TED talk in 15 minutes that you would like for me to give in 15 minutes. Okay. All right. Well, that's what I'll do. All right. So in 15 minutes, I'm going to give this TED talk to the House of Delegates of the AMA about obesity as a chronic disease. What can I say in 15 minutes to convince the AMA that obesity is a chronic disease? I'm going to give these key things in a few seconds to you guys, not 15 minutes. Don't worry. But let's break it down. And I'm just going to specifically, let's just talk about genetics, but I'm going to use animals too, and not non-human primates. I'm going to actually use man's favorite animal, which is dogs. And if you guys like cats, I'm just not your friend anymore.
Oh God, we are cat guys.
I'm going to change it. But let's look at dogs. And I'm going to use dogs because these are things that people can identify with and help us understand, because cats kind of all look the same, household cats. I mean, no shade to you guys, but let's look at dogs and let's help us understand why this genetic piece is so component. So if you have a bulldog, and you have a bulldog, you put those together, you're going to get a bulldog. If you have a chihuahua, you put a chihuahua together with a chihuahua, you're going to get a chihuahua. If you mate a bulldog with a chihuahua, you're probably going to get some hybrid animal, right? What about
a bulldog and a shih tzu?
Probably some hybrid there. But if we think about humans and their body habitus and their body type, this helps us to understand this heritability of this disease that is obesity. When you put together individuals that have certain body types, unfortunately, the mating structure is such that what is produced often looks like what you started with. Okay? I used this analogy to help people understand that heritability of this disease. It's not that you didn't want a bulldog when you produced those two bulldogs with the two bulldogs or a bulldog with the chihuahua, but you can understand the heritability of that body habitus. It isn't they did anything wrong. It's just what you put together at the outset. And so if you have two lean, tall humans or to short, stocky, or, you know, persons that carry more adipose, the likelihood that the offspring will mirror what the mom and dad look like is what it is. I want you guys to do this. We're, you know, most people will take a flight sometime soon. They'll be at the airport. And I want you to try this experiment. I want you to go and I want you to do people watching at the airport. I don't want you to go and ask, hey, is this your family member? I want you to just go do an experiment where you sit there and watch and don't talk to people. And just, I want you to identify who's the mom, who's the dad, who are the children. With no instructions, they're not going to be wearing a sign that says, I'm the mother, the father, the children. And I think very quickly, you will be able to identify without any guidance who belongs to which person. We're not looking at race. We're not looking at, you know, ethnicity. We're not looking at any of these things because, unfortunately, there is high heritability of certain traits, of which body size and type is strongly influenced. Now, I'm not saying that this cannot be modified by some of the things that we started off this conversation with. But unfortunately, that heritability of who you are comes very strongly influenced by those inputs, that heritability of who mom and dad are before you get here. So much so that by the time you're here, by the time that egg and sperm are together, that heritability is so strong, so much so that when we talk about prevention, and I'm putting on my pediatric hat, we've already influenced who that person is. And so when we talk about prevention, we're already behind the eight ball when they're already here. We have to prevent it before they're even conceived. A lot of the research that I present in terms of prevention actually talks about influencing mom and dad preconception so that we influence fetal programming, so that we have the best outcomes on weight status prior to conception.
So that's this gets into like epigenetics you're talking about, right?
But, you know, and so this is where we have the best possibility. Right now, we are dealing with 75% of the United States with overweight and obesity. When we talk about prevention, we have a very small window of actually preventing when we have that small, narrow portion of the population here in the U.S. that actually does not meet the criteria of having overweight and obesity. So we have to influence that population. It's not that we can't address this population that already has overweight and obesity. It's just saying that if we really want to have the truest impact, we have to work with that smaller subset, 25%, that doesn't have some perturbation is the word I'll use. And so that's what I want to really focus on.
Yeah. So what I, you know, I saw a lot of the comments, you know, because of the 60 Minutes thing, and a lot of people be like, well, no, it's not the genetics. It's because those people are the ones with that certain lifestyle and they give that lifestyle to their kids.
Of course,
and of course, you know, we can talk about how the genetics of obesity are in the central nervous system and are related to appetite. And then you combine that with our environment, nature and nurture together. How do you delineate those two things?
I think it's not that simple.
Right.
I mean, if it were that simple, my job would be that simple. I mean, it's so complex. I mean, I think in the work that I do and, you know, of taking care of families, and I do take care of patients from twinkle to wrinkle. My patients do range in age from 2 to 90+. In many situations, I'm taking care of the children, the parents, the grandparents, and in two situations, even the great-grandparents. I'm not shocked when a two-year-old shows up at my doorstep. Never am I shocked because I'm usually taking care of their parents. And guess what? I'm sometimes taking care of their grandparents. Grandparents. And like I said, in those situations where I'm seeing this high heritability in this family. And so do I blame them? You know, like, oh, you know what? What did you do? No, I'm like, okay, here's the family. Let me come in and let me do what I do, which is figure out what strategy I can take with each individual and recognizing that even within that family line, I'm going to have to take different strategies along that family line and with those individuals and that everything isn't going to work the same within those individual persons that are there, even though they're in that same family grouping. There are different things that may have caused that individual to develop obesity. Some of it may just be that high heritability, particularly for those really young ones. For the ones that are in that next generation, it may be for, let's say, a woman, that pregnancy may have triggered, those hormonal changes may have triggered. It may have been trauma that may have happened. It may have been medications that they were put on. There may be a variety of different reasons that may have predisposed those individuals. And so I have to do a deep dive to figure out what were the causes and what are the strategies that I'll have to utilize to get them to the healthiest weight for them.
So yeah, one of the biggest criticisms is that they basically, people are saying, oh, so you're saying everybody needs medicine? We can't do anything? We're all predetermined to have obesity if those are genetics? Okay, maybe we're not going to take the words out of your mouth. You can just tell people like, no, whatever you think.
No,
when they say that type of thing.
It's not that we're all predetermined. I think that, like I said, there's so many complexities that are associated with this. And there is no cookie cutter approach to addressing individuals. Like I said, even within a family, someone may need lifestyle, someone may need medication, someone may need surgery, someone may need all of the above. Mm-hmm. For me, it's about finding what strategy is best for the person in front of me, using that personalization to make sure that I'm doing what's best for that individual. Obviously, if I'm thinking about this on a larger scale, I help write a lot of the international guidelines. For example, the Lancet Commission guidelines will be
released. I've been waiting for those.
I'm a little bit privy to them. So I've actually read them and know that you're part of it with some of the other authors that I work with and something else. Yeah. But God forbid we say too much because we'll get in trouble for the embargo. But so I know what you got cooking and we're trying to make sure we're consistent in some other guidelines that we're working on. But awesome stuff. And it is going to be a big deal for anybody.
Well, I mean, we have those. I'm helping to write the ADA guidelines currently. The dietary guidelines for the United States were just released on Tuesday. I help write those guidelines. I'm thinking about this from all of those different lenses. But I also, and from those different guidelines perspectives, I think about from a, kind of more global view, but when I'm the person's in front of me, I have to think about what is best for them.
Yeah. Well, and then, so going back to that, cause a lot of what people seem to be, what they didn't understand, and there's not enough time for context in these TV things sometimes, but they think that, then I guess they're saying that, nutrition and exercise and all these things can't help prevent the obesity, when you just kind of laid out historically that's what you were doing. And I mean, there was another UK biobank thing from this past year looking at polygenic scores for BMI and how they had all these different scores for physical activity, diet, sedentary behavior, sleep, alcohol consumption, essentially showing that despite some high genetic risk for obesity, individuals can prevent it. But we're talking about starting early. I mean, people always ask us, and you're the same. We're all kind of cut from the same cloth to some degree, that we were doing this when we were little. I mean, our dad was a science teacher. We knew about nutrition. Cute. We were working out as little bitty kids. And it helps to do that from the beginning, let alone your parents also doing it and the epigenetics and all that stuff. And it's remarkable that how I think people just totally misconstrue stuff when they have to be so extreme, because then they say, and this actually will lead me into maybe one of the next things, but then they say, oh, well, all you doctors just get paid by pharma, and that, and she's saying that everyone needs to be on Wegovy and Zepbound now. And you just said that the statistics of how many people are struggling with obesity in the United States. Yeah. And not everyone is going to get those, or should they necessarily, but.
Yeah, no. And I think it's also important to recognize that a lot of patients with obesity have been doing these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have been working, they've been putting in the sweat equity. I think about a patient of mine who became a patient, and I really want to highlight her story. This was a woman who, had very severe obesity, but was, in the gym with me all the time. She was on, be on the spin bike. She'd be in the dance class. She'd get her salads in the cafe right afterwards, but she was about three times my size. But if you were to make assumptions, you would assume, oh, well, she's not exercising. She must not be eating well. And you would hear the trainers right outside being, well, you know, obviously she's not doing the right things, because we make these assumptions about people that carry excess adiposity that they aren't doing these things. She had been doing these things, but her body doesn't respond in the same way that my body responds to the exact same lifestyle modifications. And so we can't assume that everyone's body is going to respond the same to the exact same interventions. Lifestyle is effective for some and not for others. And so we can't assume that what will work for me will work for others. And if that doesn't work for that person, that they are should be penalized for that strategy not being a useful strategy for who they are.
Yeah, yeah, some of the pushback I get is basically, but it's just a calorie deficit. They just need to eat fewer calories than they burn. And I'm like, we know energy balance is a thing, but like, we're not going to dispute energy balance. We got to dispute the drivers that go into that to achieve
the energy balance equation is much more complex. This idea of CICO, right? Calories in, calories out. And it being a simple equation is incorrect. So when people are trying to understand that calories in, calories out model, we know that equation is incorrect. The drivers of ghrelin and cholecystokinin, peptide YY, GLP-1, GIP, all of those drivers
factors
are what people aren't paying attention to. And if you don't understand those drivers as part of the equation, you're going to fail at that equation every single time.
Yeah. You know, that part of your story is also, it's so amazingly similar. I tell my patients oftentimes or people in interviews and things like that. I always say, if you would have asked us 20 some years ago, so we were wrestling, Spencer played some football in college, you know, and back to our athletic years. And yeah, we were really into it. Like I said, with our dad, our nutrition science, our exercise science, I thought going into med school that I was going to fix everybody with their diet and exercise. I absolutely thought that. My first experience was I got a part-time personal training job, you know, at the gym when I was on my psychiatry rotation in med school. And I was beside myself that I was not able to fix them. And that was part of the trigger. And then I was lucky I had some mentors. I did my internal medicine in the Navy. And some of the, even the like different, like even a pulmonary critical care attending was, took me under his wing. It was like, there's a lot more science to this, look into this. And, you know, and then the other ones. And then of course I ended up going down endocrinology for all those exact reasons, but we thought the same. I absolutely 100% thought that I could get everyone to basically look like me if I got them to do the same things I did.
All you have to do
And we had to learn. We were wrong. Sometimes we have to learn.
We came from a cloth, going back to my dog analogy, right? We came from, you know, a cloth where I'm a woman of faith. We were blessed with certain genetic makeup. People ask, well, you know, they look at me and my sister, well, why do you guys look that way? And my sister, who is not a physician, will say, you know, a lot of it's our genetics. And she's right. We have the same mom and dad. We kind of come from the same cloth. It is great. Thanks, mom and dad, if you guys hear me. But it is what it is. So we came from this cloth, and people would say, you know, this is what they would say. I think in my early days, well, Dr. Stafford, well, why? Well, because I did my Taibo this morning and I did this, right? It was like kind of a holier than thou situation. And then I started to realize, wait a minute, but I've never had severe obesity.
Yep.
I've never struggled in the way that my patients have. So how do I equate myself to them? Because I've never been in their situation. I've never had to come 120 pounds down from where I am.
Yeah.
You know, there's just not, it's comparing apples to elephants. They're not the same. We're not comparing the same. And so as I began to learn this pathophysiology and recognize the inputs and outputs were completely different, then you start to realize, wait a minute, they've been praising me for who I am, but we are completely different, not just because I'm a Black woman, they're a Black woman, because often my patients did look like me. But we were coming from completely different milieus and circumstances that allowed my body to be here and theirs to be in a very different place.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the word blessed. I agree. We were blessed with certain genetics. Yeah. My brother had abs in utero, but I
but I'm also a foot shorter.
Yeah, but also, but we were also blessed with, you know, our dad literally had the key to the weight room. So we literally used to go when we were young. And so, and I remember, you know, other kids around me, like, you know, they're in sports and stuff, but, and they seem to be working hard with me, but like, they didn't have the same body shape as I did. Exactly. And I was honestly thinner. I had to work myself to get bigger. And then I had a similar story. Basically in med school, I tried to help my classmates lose weight. And I'm just like, what? Why can't they do this? And it wasn't till a little bit later working with patients and things like that going, yeah, I was a real idiot back then.
Well, and we started going to, you know, back even like when I was in residency and you were in med school, we started going to some of the conferences and getting into it. And like I said, we had some, I probably was a little bit lucky that I had some more mentors that were more into it. I don't know that you did necessarily. We had to go search them out later for you, but I feel like
conferences.
Right?
I had to.
Yeah, the conferences.
No, my in med school they weren't there. Residency, they sure as heck weren't there. I was
lucky
to seek them out.
I had a lot of good.
Yeah. Seek them out. So good. It's very, very similar.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, so okay. So then one thing, just because you have some experience with this, and this is something that comes up all the time on social media, especially. So it's, you know, after the 60 Minutes interview, and they say, "Oh, she's talking about medicines." They think we're all getting paid to prescribe medicines.
Yes.
Well, of course, you have been compensated for consulting. Now there's consulting and speaking. We have not been. I kind of want to. So I'm in a position right now where I'm working on this other guideline where I literally can't and haven't for a long time. But then people give us a hard time about it. You have done some consulting. I don't know that you've done any speaking necessarily.
I'm not allowed to. It's Harvard.
Harvard.
Yeah. So that's like, we have lots of friends in those. So she's not even allowed to get fees for speaking. But tell us a little bit about how... You know, because people say, well, I see that the Sunshine Act, well, she's just chilling out. But I don't know if you can articulate that or if you even know what the heck I'm trying to ask.
You know, I think this is a really important point. And I think that, you know, we should set the record straight. So for those of us that are, you know, experts in the field, what, you know, and we'll talk about obesity specifically here, which is where my expertise lies. Pharmaceutical companies want to get expertise with regards to their agent, or particularly how they should think about clinical trials, for example, in the field. One of my expertise may be looking at how do we think about clinical trials or recruitment of clinical trials in racial ethnic minority populations. There's a big study that just came out in the last few weeks that shows that none of the companies do a really great job of recruiting racial and ethnic minority populations, but obesity disproportionately affects racial and ethnic minority populations, whether you're a non-Hispanic Black individual like myself, or if you're Hispanic, or if you're a Native population, they do, on average, really poorly in recruiting in these communities. So a company might be like, okay, well, we need to think about how to critically evaluate issues like this, or how do we need to be thinking about, you know, these agents and thinking about these agents in terms of titrating medications or whatever it might be. We are not paid to prescribe these medications. I think that's an important thing of consideration, but
highly illegal and unnecessary.
Yeah, that is highly illegal. But how do we critically think about how these medications should be used in clinical practice? How do we think about how to use them in special populations? How do we think about clinical trials in these populations? These are like big questions that, you know, companies might want to consider. Who best to go to ask these questions, and the people that are the experts in the field. You wouldn't go to, let's say, the street corner and say, hey, let me ask you guys about, hey, how do you guys want to titrate that medication? You want to ask the people that are the experts. So they would come to people that are experts within a specific field, whether it be obesity or if we're talking about, you know, diabetes, or if we're talking about hypertension or obstructive sleep apnea or whatever it might be, you would go to the people that understand that patient population the best to understand how they would, you know, address it. So if we think about, let's use some case scenarios. Liraglutide was the first drug that was approved for the treatment of obesity that was a GLP-1 agonist. It was a once daily injection. And then we went from that to semaglutide, for example. How are patients going to think about a once daily injection, then switching to a once weekly injection? How are we going to think about navigating side effects like nausea or vomiting? How is that going to be in the clinic versus something like the clinical trial where patients have to titrate up on a drug? And how will that differ from when you can personalize that for a medication? These are the kinds of questions that would be really important for people that are dealing with high volumes of patients to be thinking about when you're thinking about things like advisory boards, which is where when you're looking at consultants, these are questions that you want to ask people that are consulting with regards to drugs.
Yeah. So they don't care if you prescribe the medicine. They're not going to give you more money if you prescribe more.
No, they would want you to prescribe because you wouldn't even be able to answer the question if you don't prescribe.
But they don't give you more money for prescribing.
No, you don't
give
me more money. Yeah, and actually they aren't. You don't get incentivized at all for prescribing more of the agent or whatever it might be. So that's really important for people to know.
Yeah, again, that would be highly illegal. And
that would be highly illegal.
But this is what the people on the internet
think. But
that's
what they think. And they lump it all together, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and again, I don't think it's wrong for them to seek out experts to give academic educational talks, you know, promotional talks that we could debate. No. But they don't differentiate those things. They lump it all together. And I always say, you know, even Jillian Michaels was like, I saw on your Sunshine Act, you got $2,000 from pharma last year. I was like, I really think it's fine for them to bring my staff lunch. Thank you very much.
There's no way my brother is eating a carbohydrate.
We don't take lunches. Or
yeah,
anything.
There you go. See,
there's certain institutions. So, you know, we don't speak. We don't take lunch. One of the things that for people in large academic centers where you would probably see a larger dollar amount is they may fund research.
Yeah.
So the larger amounts for people at big academic institutions, your Harvard, your Hopkins, your Mayo Clinics, your Cleveland Clinics, would be for funding research studies. How do we look at how this medication would perform in, older adults, or how would it perform in pediatric populations, or, you know, they would fund studies. And so those bigger dollar amounts, if you go and really look at the fine details, may come from funding big studies. We're going to study this drug in 500 patients. So those are going to be probably the larger sums that you would see funding a study that then gets published, that then gets spread to the larger population.
Yeah.
I love it.
That was
so
great.
They're coming to you because you're the expert, not because they're trying to incentivize you to prescriber.
That won't influence anything in terms of how I practice. Yeah. It doesn't even matter, you know, for all of these drugs, there's shortages of anything anyway. So it doesn't
matter. That's true.
But you know, for me, it's all about making sure the right patient has the right thing for these medications. It's also important to know that this is not a panacea. You know, not everyone is going to be a responder to these agents. These drugs are not appropriate for every single patient. I always tell my patients that some people come in expecting, hey, Dr. Stanford, I want to get on this agent. And I'm like, I don't think this is the right drug. I've even had patients that I've taken off of these medications that are very angry with me. And I'm like, well, I don't think you're the appropriate person. You haven't had the results that we would have anticipated. And they're like, well, I lost 4 pounds. And I said, you've lost 4 pounds over the last 60 weeks. That's not an appropriate response. So I'm a realist in terms of these medications. If this is an appropriate agent for you, great. If it's not appropriate, then we need to remove this agent because it's not an effective tool for you.
So that's you heard amazing. It, folks. She actually believes that lifestyle can prevent weight gain in those with genetic predisposition, but not everybody will respond favorably. Yeah. Not a shill for the meds.
I'm for sprints and leg press. Let's be clear.
Oh yes.
she likes lifting weights. She's an athlete herself. She follows the lifestyle herself. So it's not
awesome.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's good to hear your story. It was good to hopefully people, if anybody remembers the
CBS
60 Minutes.
I do a lot of times last week.
You'll see her all over the place.
All over the place.
But I think that was the one.
Very fun. I was at the Dilbook Summit with Prince Harry, went right after me. Before me was Serena Williams and Bill Clinton. That was a very fun experience.
Oh, wow. That's good.
Yeah, that was exciting.
Very cool.
That was fun. So the whole thing for me is just to dispel myths surrounding, you know, obesity and really make sure that that people with obesity get the respect that they deserve.
Good.
Right on the money.
We're with you there.
Way to conclude.
Where can people find you if you want to share your social media?
Absolutely. You can find me at Ask, A-S-K, Dr. Dr. Fatima, F-A-T-I-M-A, on LinkedIn, IG. Not really X. There is a profile there, but if you want to go and hang out there, you can. So that's mostly where I am. And my website is askdrfatima.com. And I'm hanging out there, all the places, all the spaces. You can feel free to find me and reach
Perfect.
Out.
Keep awesome. On doing Thank your great you. Work. Here's our outro, everyone.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.